Hello and welcome to The Selection Show. I'm Ian Heath, the news editor of Citywire Selector, and with me today I have Mick Grady, the head of investment strategy and chief economist at Aviva Investors. We're a few weeks into 2024 now, and it's an important time for fund houses to be thinking about the year ahead. So today we're going to be talking about what Aviva Investors' expectations for the global economy are and how they're adjusting their investment strategy accordingly. Mick, I understand Aviva Investors think global growth will be a bit slower this year compared to 2023. Why is that?
Yeah, no, that's right. We do think we'll see a bit of a slowdown this year. So we sort of saw around sort of 3.25% last year, and we're looking more like 2.75% growth globally this year. The main drivers there, we think, are somewhat of a slowdown in the US relative to last year. I think US was probably the big surprise in 2023 in terms of how rapidly it grew.
Yeah.
But we do expect to see somewhat of a slowdown there. We are still, to be honest, a bit above consensus, though, in that view of a slowdown, but a slowdown to around about what we consider sort of normal or trend growth in the US, around 1.75%. We also think that there'll be a further slowdown in China. China has been pretty weak on the back end of last year, and we expect that to continue into this year.
And do you think there'll be any recessions in any regions?
So we don't have a recession in our central forecast for any of the major economies.
Okay.
And, you know, we have skirted pretty close to technical recession. In fact, in the UK, we may guess a technical recession in the sense of having 2 quarters of negative growth at the back end of 23. We haven't got the final data yet. But no, we don't think in our central projection that we see a recession, but some pretty sort of tepid growth in certain regions, I would say.
And you mentioned the US economy doing quite well last year. Do you feel the global economy generally has sort of held up quite well compared to perhaps expectations at the start of 2023?
Yeah, look, I mean, like probably many forecasters, back at the end of 2022, we thought that there would be a mild recession in 2023. As I said, I think that was a fairly consensus view at that time. So we, like others, were surprised at the robustness that we saw across the major economies. As I said before, I mean, the US in particular, really, I mean, we basically saw better growth in 23 than we did in 22 in the US, which was really unexpected, I think. And if you sort of dig into, you know, why was that?
Yeah, of course.
What was the driver of that? I think the big surprise there was if you look at the sort of implied fiscal stimulus that came through in the US last year, it was actually, you know, if you exclude things like the global financial crisis or the COVID year, it was actually the biggest fiscal stimulus that we've seen in the US really at any time in the last 30 years, if you take those 2 years out. So that certainly was not what anybody expected going into 23. And I think it made a significant difference. You know, household spending just stayed really strong throughout the entire course of the year. And in fact, we got the US GDP data for Q4 just today. And once again, it surprised on the upside.
Oh, sure, yes.
3.3% annualized. Yep. So yeah, lots of robustness there. I think the other thing I'd say about last year, which was a surprise, at least in terms of the sort of non-recession outcome, was the UK and the Eurozone.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to remember the sort of magnitude or scale of the shock that was faced, you know, by the UK and the Eurozone in terms of the energy increases.
Yeah.
Obviously, those were somewhat mitigated by subsidy and government policy. But it was still an enormous hit to real income. Pretty, you know, certainly in the UK numbers, the biggest hit in 50 years to real income growth. And despite that, your spending held up okay. I mean, essentially the UK economy has been pretty flat for the last 12 to 18 months, but you would have expected quite a lot worse outcome than that, given the magnitude of the shock. So there has been resilience even in those places where the growth has been pretty slow or non-existent.
And of course, the one place which was kind of a bit disappointing for a lot of people was China. I mean, were you surprised by what happened there as well?
Yeah, look, I mean, we thought that once the reopening started, you know, I'm sure you remember the way in which the China reopening came about was unexpected in itself.
Yes.
I mean, that was expected to take much longer to come about. They sort of, you know, flipped pretty quickly on it. And we expected that, you know, China wouldn't be that different to what we'd seen elsewhere around the world as countries reopened. You had this level of pent-up demand, savings that had been built up from being able to go out and spend and so on, and that would all be deployed and you would see really a very, very strong year come out of China. The reality was, yes, you did see a big recovery immediately in Q1 of last year, and then things slowed down quite a lot subsequently. And I think, you know, that just sort of underlined to us, you know, this sort of really structural weakness that is driven by primarily the property sector.
Of course, sure, yeah.
Really having such a huge impact also on confidence and consumer confidence.
And that's been quite an ongoing problem for a few years now.
It has, you're right. And we think it continues. So
yeah.
It's one area where we're a bit out of consensus, if you like, in terms of our growth outlook for this year, is we do think China won't reach their growth target for this year.
I think that
5% target again this year. We're weaker than that. And that's, you know, really because we sort of struggle to see without really much more significant policy intervention how they're going to be able to generate that level of growth. That said, things never stay still for very long, and we have actually seen some more aggressive intervention from the Chinese authorities just in the last week.
Yeah,
further cut to the reserve ratio requirement, further packages to support the banking system, and so on. So they are looking to do more. Maybe that's a signal that there's more support to come. But based on what we know at the moment, we think China's going to be weaker than consensus this year.
Okay, sure. Thanks, Michael. Okay, let's talk central banks a little. What sort of, we've seen some activity today, actually, but what sort of activity do you think we'll see from central banks this year? There seems to be a growing consensus that we're going to see rate cuts.
Yeah. And we agree with that. One of the sort of key investment themes we highlight this year is the likelihood that we start to see rate cuts from really all of the major central banks this year. I think, you know, there's still an open question on timing, exactly when those might start. We're minded to think it's probably around Q2 for, you know, the Federal Reserve, the ECB and the Bank of England, probably all in and around Q2, maybe Q3. There's a bit of a question on timing, and there's obviously also a question on, you know, how fast and how far they go. Market pricing currently is for the Fed to do about 200 basis points over a couple of years. The ECB and the Bank of England a bit less than that. We're not necessarily in a huge disagreement with the market in terms of the magnitude of cuts expected, but what we know is that the likelihood that we kind of have this almost perfect sort of central case soft landing, which, you know, as I said,
is
more or less our own view, that delivers, you know, inflation kind of back to central bank targets and policy rates coming back to what we might think of as kind of neutral. It's hard to deliver on that. You know, there's any number of possible things that could go wrong or be different to get a different outcome to that.
Okay, sure. You mentioned inflation there. I mean, how concerned are you that, you know, we might see another inflation shock? There are risks out there.
There are. I mean, so in terms of the disinflation process, it has gone a long way from where we were. Remember that last year we're in double digits for most economies in terms of headline inflation rates, and we've come down a lot since then. A lot of that has to do with the decline in energy prices that has happened, whilst initially the stabilization and then decline. And that's particularly in Europe, for example, on natural gas prices, which have come down, you know, significantly from where they were last year. And so that's made a huge impact in terms of bringing inflation further down. Goods inflation, core goods inflation, again, it's actually quite soft now. You know, there's very little global goods inflation. And so, yeah, that's largely a reflection of what's a pretty weak manufacturing backdrop globally. And that kind of just leaves services, and services is kind of the big unknown, I would say, still at this stage. It's still holding up and is really more of a function of tightness of domestic labour markets, wage pressures, and so on and so forth. And those still look perhaps somewhat challenging, and maybe be the one of the reasons why inflation doesn't continue falling, perhaps at the rate in which we've seen it more recently. I would just flag up a couple of things, though, in terms of, you know, what could actually get it moving back in the other direction. Because there's one thing, just if you like, to slow or stop that disinflationary process. It's another thing entirely, I think, to say, well, could we actually see it picking back up again from here? I think in order to get that outcome, we would have to see something fairly material happen with energy prices. They're usually the swing factor when it comes to headline inflation.
Okay, sure.
You know, it's obviously not impossible that we could have that outcome.
Does it likely trigger some sort of geopolitical thing like Australia?
I mean, you know, we still have war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
You know, we have all sorts of troubles, as we know, in the Middle East. And so it's entirely possible that we could see energy prices go back up again. We obviously are also seeing, you know, shipping costs rising again now as ships have been diverted away from, you know, away from the Gulf. So you know, there are some risks there. I think, as you say, I think they're largely geopolitical risks. But you look at, you know, something like global energy markets. I mean, they are still pretty tight, so it doesn't take a huge shock. I guess that is the thing, to see prices perhaps going back up again.
Okay, bear in mind everything we've just discussed. How is Aviva Investors changing its investment strategy to, you know, or mitigate or reflect these trends and sort of deal with, you know, what might lie ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the most significant change we've made at the sort of high level asset allocation view towards the end, well, sort of later on last year and looking forwards, was around our view on duration. So we'd been underweight duration, had that view for a long time, two and a half years. We had an underweight duration view. We aren't there anymore. We have an overweight duration view going forwards, and as I said, have done since late last year. And that's, you know, unsurprisingly, you know, consistent with the view that we are moving into a rate cutting cycle.
Of course, yeah.
You know, we probably see that there's more opportunity on the duration side in Europe, the UK. US maybe is a bit more fairly valued, we think, at this point in time. But that's probably, in terms of the change from where we've been, the most notable. In terms of on the equity side, we remain with an overweight equity view, you know, moderately overweight equity view. Again, with some differentiation by region, but that's been more consistent, I would say.
Well, you mentioned China earlier on, which you're kind of straying away from a little bit. Could you just talk us through where you're interested regions-wise, or maybe what your underweights, overweights might be?
Yeah, no, sure. So, I mean, in terms of maybe we start on the equity side, actually, on equities. So we have a preference to be more overweight the US and Japan.
Okay.
In terms of the US, look, you know, the valuations do look pretty rich. So you know, it's not a cheap market by any stretch of the imagination. But the earnings, we think the earnings numbers for this year are going to look pretty decent. If you like, we've already had the earnings recession in the US. It kind of came and went without the economic recession. And so, you know, if earnings can deliver this year, which we think they will, we think there's still plenty of scope for upside.
On the US market, what's your view on this kind of concentration that we've had on the so-called Magnificent Seven? Do you think that's an issue? Do you think there's a bit of a bubble there? Or do you think, like, you know, that it should be more spread out, the rally that we've seen?
Yeah, look, I mean, certainly for a good part of last year, we felt somewhat uncomfortable about the narrowness of the rally in the US. Late on in the year, by Q4, though, it did actually expand out quite a lot. And so it wasn't just a Magnificent Seven story. By the time we got to Q4, when you know, we saw a lot of the rally, obviously, at the sort of index level. So we felt a bit more comfortable about, you know, the ability of the market to sustain, if you like, that momentum, given it was a little bit less narrow than what it was earlier in the year. Look, you know, when you get these potential, you know, game-changing moments for companies that, you know, AI technology might be, then, you know, it's very difficult to call whether that's going to be a bubble or not. As I say, we're just sort of more comfortable that it has broadened out since then. But just coming back to where I was before, I think Japan's an interesting one. I see here today, the Japanese market's up 10% already this year, I think. But we've had the view for quite some time that there is significant and important change going on in Japan.
Yeah.
Both in terms of the sort of corporate governance and dynamics there, the appetite for increasing shareholder return, but also on a macroeconomic level in terms of, if you like, the defeating of deflation, a deflationary mindset. We think that there's genuinely something changing there. So, it's a cheap market, and I think it has those things going for it. So we like Japan as well.
Well, that's on the equity side, but on the bond side.
On the bond side, yeah. So, I mean, if you like, what comes with that, if we're right, is what you might think of as a more normalization in Japan of bond market and interest rates there. So we are very underweight Japanese government bonds. And that's really, as I say, predicated on the view that if Japan genuinely has been able to exit this deflationary mindset of 30 years, really, that gives the Bank of Japan the opportunity to actually end, we used to call them unconventional policies, but they've been going on for so long with so many central banks, they're not so unconventional anymore. But these policies around yield curve control and negative interest rates, we think they're in a process of unwinding those already. We think that will continue. We're expecting negative interest rate policy to end in the first half of this year. If we get that loosening the reins on yield curve control, we think there is scope for Japanese yields to move quite a lot higher from where they are today. So we see that as a positive, to be honest, in terms of a normalization of things in the Japanese economy, rather than being a negative for risk assets, which you might typically think of as being the case, but actually is part of the healing and improvement and things in Japan. And a move away from this idea that Japan is made up of this sort of zombie companies that only survive because of very low interest rates and so on and so forth, that hopefully is being consigned to the past.
Okay, yeah, and that's with these corporate reforms we see in M&A reforms, that sort of thing, yeah.
Correct.
So that's right. Interesting.
Yeah. No, reforms, in terms of boards and so on and so forth. So, no, it's I think it's an interesting story. I mean, Japan has been under-owned by the market for so long, not, unreasonably, perhaps you might argue. And so I think, that provides good opportunity.
Okay, and any regions you're kind of straying from? We've already mentioned China.
Yeah, so I mean, it's in terms of our equity views, that's probably where our largest underweight is currently.
Okay.
In the emerging market space, but the emerging market space is at an index level is so dominated by China, given the size, obviously. I said it before, we remain pretty concerned about the sort of structural backdrop for China. What they need to work through in terms of essentially this debt deleveraging process is going to take many, many years. Their concerns, I think, and in terms of what the government is more focused on, what President Xi is more focused on, is around national security and self-sufficiency rather than economic growth, which, of course, for China, that's all it was for so long was economic growth.
Of course, yeah.
And we don't think they're in that space anymore. And so that makes us very cautious around Chinese assets.
It is, of course, a very big market, though. Is there kind of any sectors within it that you'd stay interested in?
Look, I mean, we'd always be prepared to, consider, if you like, more short-term or tactical views. We don't have any particular at the moment, I wouldn't say. I guess what I'd say in terms of the biggest risk, I guess, to our underweight view is not so much around a sort of tactical sector a view for China, but actually it's when the authorities come out with a particular policy, which was flagged. For example, this week, that they are going to apparently strongly encourage, maybe even more than strongly encourage, direct purchases into the market by the state-owned enterprises,
right,
and use some of the FX reserves as well. So, you know, I think it's really challenging when you have, you know, what is kind of a very manipulated market to hold sort of strong fundamental views.
Yeah, yeah, well, things can change very quickly and
exactly.
can be quite unexpected as well. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, sure. Just finishing off, Mick, what are the sort of big risks or hazards you might be keeping an eye on this year? One thing perhaps worth discussing, there's going to be a lot of political elections this year.
Yes.
I was wondering if that's something you keep an eye on. I think it's 45% of the world is going to the polls this year.
Yeah, so many people have tried to calculate this number as to what is the number. I've heard 45, I've heard 65, I've heard all sorts, but it's a lot, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
End of the day, it's a big number. A lot of the world is going to some form of election this year. Of course, the fact that India has elections this year makes a big difference to the percentage number.
Sure.
But no, look, I mean... obviously, I would say the one that, you know, most people are going to be focused on is the US, with already, I guess, more or less got to the situation where it's fairly clear that, you know, Trump will be the Republican candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, based on current polling, at least, you know, current polling would suggest he would win if the election was held today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very complex with the electoral college system in the US. It's not just about who's the most popular candidate and wins the most votes, as we know. It's more complicated than that. But at the end of the day, you know, we probably think it's down to two or three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. Whoever wins those three probably wins the presidency. And at the moment, Trump's polling in the lead in all of those states. Now, I think, you know, one sort of caveat to that is, of course, the election isn't going to be held today. It's going to be in November, and things can change between now and then. And typically, the incumbent does get a bit of a benefit as you get closer to the actual polling day. And, you know, that could be enough to make it, you know, much closer or even change the balance in favor of Biden. But, you know, what I think, you know, all investors are probably thinking to themselves is, well, if we do have a change of president, a second round, Trump 2.0, how much does it look like the first one?
Well, that's what some people have mentioned to me recently. They're actually both kind of known quantities now. When Trump was elected in 2016, nobody was quite sure what we were going to get. And you could probably say the same Biden 2020, but we have actually had a dose of both already.
We have. And you know, Trump's not shy in saying what his policies are going to be. And it is kind of more of the same. So, you know, he said 10% tariffs on everyone.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of more of what he previously
did. Yeah.
He said tax cuts, and that's what he did previously as well. You know, he's talked about taking the US out of NATO, which he talked about previously.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So on and so forth. So you're right. Many of the things he's saying sound very similar to when he was actually in office. I think perhaps the important difference, though, is the economic backdrop isn't the same as when he was in office. And we've just been through, obviously, a period of you know, high inflation. The US is already running very large fiscal deficits, projected to do so for another 4 years under a Biden presidency as well.
Yep.
And the, you know, those could be even larger under a Trump presidency. You know, I think it ended up being a very positive event for markets, the previous Trump presidency. You know, equity markets ultimately ended up loving it because of all the tax cuts and so on. There was a lot of volatility, of course, because of the way in which, although arguably he communicated in the tariffs and so on, but ultimately it was a positive. It's not so clear cut, I think, this time around. You know, if you're sort of potentially restoking inflation through, you know, domestic policies, I think, you know, the Federal Reserve are going to be, you know, quite concerned about, you know, what the impact of that could be as well. So I think that's kind of an important difference. But yes, there are of course other elections here in the UK. We have election coming up later this year.
Yep.
Again, you know, I would say the polling is more clear cut, shall we say, at this point in time, in terms of it being a likely Labour victory. Of course, the the sort of fiscal situation that Labor will inherit at that point will be pretty constraining for them, I think. And so I think, yeah, it's unlikely we see dramatic policy shift, even with a change of government.
Okay, sure. Okay, well, that's 2024 summed up, Mick. Thanks very much for that. Maybe you'll come back in 2025 and we'll review what we've discussed today. But thanks very much for dropping in. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.